Members, we will call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order. And as is our custom in the House Commerce Committee, we are going to start out with a program from the Department of Agriculture. And we will kind of try to move things. I know members have to get to conference committees this morning, so we'll try to move along relatively quickly. But with that, if the folks from the Department of Ag want to come down and do the presentation, we're ready to start whenever you are. Good morning and welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Vobel. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I oversee the Ag Marketing and Development Division, which houses our biofuels program. So I'm just going to do a quick presentation on our biodiesel study or our biodiesel report, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. So just a quick start on what biodiesel is. It's a renewable, clean-burning diesel replacement that's made from a diverse mix of feedstocks. Biodiesel is made through a chemical process where a renewable oil is reacted with an alcohol to produce methyl esters, which is the biodiesel, and glycerin, which is a byproduct that can be sold for other things like soap and other products. Feedstocks, an example of some feedstocks is recycled cooking oil, soybean oil, and animal fats. I think most people are familiar with soybean oil being used in biodiesel. There are currently three biodiesel plants in Minnesota right now. There's the Renewable Energy Group, or REG, in Albert, Minnesota. The Minnesota Soybean Processors have a plant in Brewster, Minnesota. And Evergat Fuels.
Could we get you try to speak into the microphone a little bit more? We try to keep things on the kind of on the down low here in the basement. But
Got it. Okay.
Thank you.
And then Evergat Fuels out of Isanti, Minnesota. And Minnesota's biodiesel nameplate capacity, production capacity, is at 63 million gallons. Feedstocks are mostly determined by price and availability. And given the large soybean oil crushing capabilities we have in Minnesota, a large portion of what we use is Minnesota corn. And supply of biodiesel fuel in Minnesota has largely been constant. If there's been any issues, it's usually due to some sort of machine or equipment maintenance or short delivery delays. But for the most part, it's been pretty constant. The timeline of the biodiesel mandate here in Minnesota, the law was passed in 2002 and it was implemented for the first time in 2005. We became the first state to implement legislation mandating the use of biodiesel into its diesel fuel supply at a level of 2% or B2, and I just note the statute there. May 1st, 2009, the mandate was increased to 5% or what we know as B5. July 1st, 2014, the mandate was increased to 10% or B10. And B10 is in effect for the summer months, which is April through September, and B5 is used during the winter months, which is October through March. Originally, we were supposed to go to B10 in May 1st of 2012, but we did delay it 2 years and a couple months due to some issues we came across, and I'll go into those later. And May 1st, 2018 is when the mandate is scheduled to move to B20 for the summer months. So the Biodiesel Task Force was created in 2003 to help carry out the biodiesel mandate. It meets on an ad hoc basis to discuss issues related to biodiesel production and use. Our next meeting of the Biodiesel Task Force has just been scheduled for June 9th of 2017. Subteams have been formed to address more specific issues, for instance, the cold weather operability issue, and they are appointed by the Commissioner of Agriculture. Sectors represented go from education research institutions, farm organizations and grower groups, oil and fat processors, the petroleum industry, fuel user groups, and environmental groups. So we have a wide range of representatives on the task force. There are some exceptions to the law. Number one, diesel is not required to go along with the mandate. Railroad locomotives, off-road taconite and copper mining equipment, logging equipment, and Coast Guard vessels, and there are a few others. But I think it's important to note that there are a few industries that don't have to abide by the mandate. The law states that there are four conditions that need to be met to move to B20. An ASTM standard must exist, and ASTM is the American Society for Testing and Materials, and it's an international group that sets those standards, and that is met. There is one that exists today. There needs to be a sufficient supply of 50% or more demand, adequate statewide blending infrastructure, and 5% supply need to be from alternative feedstock. And alternative feedstocks are things like algae cultivated for biofuels production, waste oils, and tallow. By statute, there has to be a meeting of the biodiesel task force to occur before we go to B20. And again, as I mentioned, it's going to be on June 9th, 2017. The determination needs to be made by the Commissioners of Agriculture, the Pollution Control Agency, and Commerce, so all three commissioners must agree. And a notice must be given to the public and the legislature 270 days prior to the scheduled increase. So that would mean that we need to put something in the state register probably about late August of this year. So having the biodiesel task force meeting June 9th gives us some time to review all of the things that we hear at the biodiesel task force and make a decision by the end of August. I also want to note that folks who have concerns or want to voice some support or whatever they'd like to do about the mandate, they don't have to save it for the biodiesel task force meeting. They are allowed to talk to us at any point in time. So we've met with a number of groups who are interested in the mandate prior to this task force, and we're willing to meet with them at any time. There are, like, what we'd like to say, off-ramps to the law. I think the statute was written very well in that way. Conditions may be waived if weather-related conditions render necessary feedstock unavailable. So if there's, you know, an unforeseen weather issue that makes some of those feedstocks unavailable to the biodiesel plants. If commissioners find that the use of non-traditional feedstocks would be uneconomic under market conditions, the Commissioner of Commerce may also temporarily suspend the mandate if there are issues with supplier quality. And the governor may issue an executive order adjusting the mandate if it causes economic hardship to retailers. So again, I think the statute was written very well, that if there are issues that come up that are unforeseen after the mandate is implemented, there are ways to pause those things at that time. So as I said, it was going to be very quick, so I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Vauble. We always appreciate brevity. Representative Lunan has a question.
You talked about the different exceptions, railroad. What was the premise for exempting them? It seemed like this is, if it's good for one, it's good for all. And I'm just wondering what the motive was or what was the objective of that?
Ms. Vauble.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would say that I think, you know, I wasn't around when that happened, but I would say that I think there were some issues with some gelling and waxing early on, but those issues have been monitored and addressed. So I would say there were some issues just with some of how the engines are comprised. But I would allow the industry folks when they come up here to address that issue as well.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Vauble. You mentioned that Minnesota was one of the first states to implement a mandate. Could you tell me what they currently are for the state of North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin, which are our surrounding states, please?
Ms. Vauble.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fenton, I can't speak to the other states. I'm not sure at this point, but others might know. I just know that Minnesota has the mandate, and we're in charge of implementing that.
Is there anybody here who would have the answer to that? I'd like to.
Representative Fenton, I think we have a number of other people who are going to come up and testify, and if at the end we don't find somebody, we're going to start randomly grilling people in the audience. We'll catch up to that as we get other testifiers. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Vauble, good morning. You mentioned the task force, and I'm interested. Is that, how often does that meet? When was the last time it met? And do they have reports that we could read? Because I'm kind of interested in what that would say.
Ms. Vauble.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash. So as I mentioned, we meet on an ad hoc basis, so as needed. We do have, we take comments as people like to submit them. For instance, when we do the biodiesel report each year, there is a space that we ask for comments from the biodiesel task force, and we will publish those along with the report so people can see what comments they have. We did have some folks who submitted comments after we released the report, and so we did re-release it and add those comments in. So those comments can be seen in the biodiesel report that we release each year.
Representative Nash, is that follow-up?
We're good.
Representative Wilders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for clarification. Ms. Vauble, the biomass fuels are used to replace other fuels for things like, well, if we've got a handler who's got a bus on it and different kinds of things. Am I correct in that assessment?
Ms. Vauble.
Mr. Chair, can you, sir, can you repeat the question? I just didn't hear it very well.
Sure. My understanding would be that the use for the biomass would be to reduce other kinds of fuels for things that might be for buses or for other kinds of transportation or vehicles. That I'll get right to the chase of it. That would otherwise be subject to the gas tax or fuel tax. Am I correct?
Ms. Wobble.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure about that. I can't speak to that, but I can certainly look into it.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would like to know a little bit more about that, if there's ever been a fiscal note or if there's ever been a financial analysis on this. For ever since I've been at the legislature, I've asked the question, when we use alternative fuels for vehicles and electric and propane and these things, they're not subject to the gas tax or fuel tax, but yet they're on the roads, and so those people who own individual passenger vehicles are asked to pick up a larger load of the cost of maintaining those roads and the like. And I guess I'd just be kind of interested at some point to see what the fiscal impact would be on this as a result of the substitute fuel. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Nash had a follow-up.
I did. The caffeine just kicked in. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you said that it had the task force had met in the past, and I don't know that you gave me a date when it had met last. Can you get us the reports for those? I have the most recent report from January of 16. I'd kind of like to read what had happened in the past to see the progression from the various levels until here we are today. Mm-hmm. So can you get us that through the CA and maybe get us I'd like to read that if I could.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, that's absolutely, we're happy to do that. All of those are listed on our website, so we can easily get those.
And the last time that you did meet was when?
Gosh, I think I'd have to check into that. It was before I took over this position. Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I'm getting the audience is telling me 2014 is when we met last.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Wobble.
Thank you, Ms. Wobble. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, is there a scheduled meeting forthcoming?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, June 9th, Friday, June 9th from 1 to 3 at the agency's office, room B555.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, is it typical that 3 years would go by without this committee meeting?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, we just meet on an ad hoc basis, so if somebody wants to call a biodiesel task force meeting, we're happy to oblige. It's just that we just haven't saw the need for it at that time, just because we've been kind of monitoring the industry as it goes on before we implement B20.
Thank you, Ms. Wobble.
Mr. Chair, thank you. To the testifier, so I understand we'll be reading all these reports, but just as a general feel, I understand ad hoc and I understand the nature of what that means, but is typically every 3 year it meets, or do you meet every month but it's been a 3 year lapse? Give me a feel for how often there's been these meetings, outside of the last 3 years.
Ms. Wobble.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, again, I don't know exactly, I could get you that amount of times that we've met since it started in 2003. But again, it doesn't meet every month. It's, again, when we feel it's needed. We want to get all the stakeholders together. But again, outside of the biodiesel task force meeting, we do speak with those stakeholders quite frequently and are willing to meet with them at any point that they have concerns.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Testifier, so you meet regularly. How many members normally are in these conversations? Would it be, obviously there's not a quorum for the meeting to be held, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. Seems how it's been 3 months, or 3 years. But I look forward to seeing these reports, because it's, between a year and 3 months, between these regular conversations, and it's been 3 years since you've had these discussions with them. So I'm curious if there have been a lot of discussions with them in the last 3 years.
Ms. Ball.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, absolutely. We're talking to folks constantly. I know we've met with people like Flint Hills and Magellan just a couple months ago. We talked to them quite frequently. Again, we meet with the soybean growers, REG, we've met with. Anybody who wants to meet with us, we are happy to meet. And you can see all of the biodiesel task force members in the report. So when I get that, you can take a look at everyone who is actually on the task force.
Thank you, Ms. Wobble.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. To the testifier, so are these individual conversations recorded and notes kept?
Ms. Wobble.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I would say they're not recorded. I would say that I, you know, take notes, but there's not official minutes or anything like that.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you be willing to submit those notes to the committee?
Ms. Wobble.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Smith, or Representative Smith, I'd be happy to if I can take a look and see if I have them still.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wobble. Not seeing any other questions. Thank you. Nice job. And as is our custom here in the Commerce Committee, after we hear from the Department of Agriculture, we are going to hear from Metro Transit. Members, we do now have a quorum. So, Representative Kreisha, I'm assuming that you have had a chance to peruse the minutes from our last meeting. Representative Kreisha would like to move approval of the minutes from our last meeting. Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Members, any comments, concerns, questions? Seeing none, those in favor of Representative Kreisha's move to adopt those minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Members, any opposed, same sign. Seeing none, the minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Finest adoption of minutes we've had all year. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Vince Pellegrin. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Metro Transit. I have operational responsibility for the bus system, for light rail, and for North Star Commuter Rail.
I'm Steve Carey. I work in the maintenance department at Metro Transit. And I oversee the fuel blends and the biodiesel usage.
Welcome. Please proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Just to start out, a little overview of our operation. We have five service garages in the metro area. We have over 900 buses. We operate daily. We have two garages in Minneapolis area. One is the Haywood Garage. One is the Nicollet. We have one in St. Paul. It's the East Metro Garage. We have one in Bloomington, right by the airport. It's the South Garage. Then one in Brooklyn Center. At all those garages, you can see the various quantities of fuel we store. We have about approximately a two-week, or maybe a little bit more storage available. In case we have fuel interruptions or we don't have regular deliveries. The total capacity for the whole system is 289,000 gallons, roughly 289,000 gallons. this capacity is turned over approximately every 2.5 weeks. So we use quite a bit of diesel and biodiesel. Right here is throughout the year, in order to use the biodiesel, we're required to blend it to make sure the cold weather operability is conducive to the current temperatures. Basically, if the we want to prevent waxing or gelling, so the buses are reliable throughout the year. Just a little brief overview of the chart. In the winter months, we reduce our bio content to about 2.5%. We take B5 and we blend 50% of that with straight number one. The state's currently offered a waiver until 2020, allowing us to use number one along with the bio component. So what that does in the winter, with along with a cold weather improver or a chemical additive, allows us to have a cold filter plug point of about 30 below. So we're in the cold weather months. It's 20 below. Our main concern is the reliability. The buses have to operate effectively every day at any temperature, whether it be 95 degrees or 20 below. So in the winter time, we reduce the level of bio down to about 2.5. And as the year, as we progress through the year, towards the summer months, we ramp it up. In the late part of April, we've been moving to a B20 blend, and that's because of the rise in temperatures, and the cloud point is conducive to doing that. We run that basically until the end of September, and then we ramp back down with lower levels going to B5 or B10 and then to B5 and then back into the 50-50 blend in the cold weather. Just a little, the different components throughout the year that we use the number one, in the winter primarily, and that's a little over a million gallons. The number five component is also, used in the winter time as well, and that's, roughly 2.3 million. And then the 10% bio has been, around the 600,000 range, and then nearly 3 million gallons of B20.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, do you have a copy of these slides that you can hand out to the committee members?
I have a copy I could make copies of.
In our packet. Representative Smith, we have it in our packet, and we can also use, I assume that's on the Metro Transit website?
It
on
is.
Our website.
It's. We sent the report over.
Gotcha.
Okay. So I can get copies made.
Okay. No, I think we're okay. We have copies that were handed out, and it's on, Representative Smith, I misunderstood, it's on our committee website.
Okay.
Please proceed. Thank you.
Okay. This next slide is just a representation of the gallons of biodiesel we've used over the years. As you can see, we've had some challenges in the beginning with the filter plugging and the monoglyceride fallout or coming out of solution and plugging filters. Through some maintenance efforts and some improvements in the industry, we've ramped up our bio usage. So we started off, we have 208,000 gallons in 2011, and we moved up to 772,000 gallons in 2016. It's been a steady progression, and we've last couple of years we've been using it very successfully without a lot of issue. Here's another chart that kind of just shows the progression of the use of the bio, as well as you can see, our fuel usage throughout the year, we're about 6.9 million gallons a year is what we use in fuel. So about 11.1% of that is pure biodiesel, renewable bio. As we look, we could see us progressing forward in the levels of bio we were able to use. We had some challenges in the beginning, and here's some of the steps that we put forth to get where we are today. So all 1116 fuel storage tanks are above ground and heated to 60 degrees Fahrenheit. Previously, we had a lot of underground storage tanks, and they were prone to moisture and some microbial growth and other contaminants. So once we moved above ground, the tanks were a lot easier to manage, and the fuel remained dry. It's very important to have clean and dry fuel. The vents on the storage tanks have been fitted with water inhibiting, they call them desiccant filters. So the moisture in the air is filtered out. As you remove the fuel from the tank and put it in the buses, it's replaced by air, and that air is filtered to remove all the moisture content. Metro Transit, we perform monthly maintenance checks on all fuel delivery systems. We look for leaks. We make sure all the O-rings are fitted correctly and the filters are in place and all up to date. So we look at that on a monthly basis. And then the fuel dispenser filters are, we fitted them with 10 micron filters to ensure prior to putting the fuel in the bus that the fuel is clean and free of debris. The B100 fuel that we buy must comply with the BQ9000 specifications. Thus, they look at the monoglyceride content and ensure it's at a manageable level. And then the fuel storage tanks are, on an annual basis, we do quite a bit of We do testing on the fuel storage tanks, and also we do testing on the loads that are delivered. But in this case, we test for mold and microbial growth on an annual basis, and water, sediment, or anything of that nature. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pellegrin, did you want to?
No. We'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. I think we've got a few. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions for the testifiers, and feel free to jump in either one. So I had spoken to a lot of farmers in my district, and they, too, have said that they, if they truly intend to use it for a long time, they have to heat the tanks. And you said that you heat your tanks to 60 degrees Fahrenheit. Question, what energy source do you use to heat the tanks? And what is the increased cost over time that you've seen that you're going to have to you create to heat the B20 when it comes in? I'm just curious because obviously it's going to want to gel up. What's the cost to Metro Transit to heat those tanks?
Gentlemen, whoever wants to take it, feel free.
Mr. Chair, we typically heat it with gas, natural gas or diesel fuel. We from our boiler heat from the building. We use that heat. We have separate little heaters that are placed in the rooms that heat it. I'm not sure what the additional costs for heating those rooms are.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Dash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, do you use do you use B20 to heat the B20 tanks, or use number one, or what do you use,
Mr. Conroy?
Mr. Chair, we use B20 to heat the diesel. We use the fuel from the fuel tanks.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair,
Representative Dash.
Another question. Again, I'm talking to a lot of the farmers in my district. They talked about the increased cost of filtration.
Mm-hmm.
How often do you have to do that on your PM schedule to make sure you're putting in good filters, and how often does that happen, and what are the cost of that based on change over time?
Mr. Curry.
Mr. Chair, the fuel filter replacement varies throughout the year. In the wintertime, when we are down to, a B2.5, we're doing it about a monthly basis. We have to replace them approximately once a month. During the summer months, when we get up to about a B20 level, it can go from about 2 weeks, a week and a half to 2 weeks. They monitor the gallons of flow per minute out of the fuel dispensers, and once it hits a certain point, then they realize it needs a filter change, and they change the filter. And a lot of times, they will even go beyond 2 weeks. When we reach the higher temperatures, be it like the 70s and the 80s in the midsummer, they can go easily over 3 weeks. In the early part of the year, when it's a little bit colder, then we're maybe down to a week and a half, occasionally even a week.
Okay. Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, and I'll wrap up here. I know I have a tendency to get in the weeds on things sometimes, and I saw that smile.
If Representative Nash, none of us have ever noticed that.
Yeah. If Mr. Shetton, who I know is here, if Mr. Shetton could get me some of those numbers on the economics of heating and filtration, I'd appreciate that. Just kind of curious about it.
Representative Nash, he's behind you nodding and smiling. He'd be happy to do that.
He loves my questions, I know.
Everyone does. Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, you mentioned that the storage tanks are now above ground.
Correct.
But they were below ground to start with. So I guess, when Metro Transit started to move toward using the biodiesel, was it your intent that it would be fine just work like regular fuel to store it underground?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Curry.
Mr. Chair, Representative, our fuel tanks are above ground as we replaced our underground tanks.
Mm-hmm.
We put the new tanks above ground. It's much easier to monitor the leakage. There's some very specific requirements on leak detection and fuel storage. So we went ahead and just put our tanks above ground to facilitate that. And it facilitates our ability to heat those tanks now in order to ensure that the biodiesel that we use doesn't gel up on us.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is it common for these types of tanks to leak and have mold issues? And, how common is that?
Mr. Pellegrin?
And does it happen with regular fuel?
Mr. Chair, Representative, our underground tanks, they can be there for 20, 30 years, and they leak. And so we were always testing them for leaks, and it's harder to deal with them when they're leaking. So we wind up replacing those tanks, mitigating the soils, and then going ahead, and it's much much easier for an above-ground tank now. We have the way they're placed, the plumbing, everything that has leak potential. We have what's called the pressure differential gauges on the system, so we can tell when there's a leak. We're much better at that technology as we've progressed in tank replacement.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And would you say that it's do most of the consumers of this type of biodiesel do the same thing? I mean, is it common that it's above ground and to monitor and to keep it heated and whatnot? Is that common, or all the other consumers do it, or is this something that you guys have done just so you can manage better for the purpose of Metro Transit?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't believe that's common. Truck stops, things like that, all their tanks are underground. We made the conscious decision to put our tanks above ground because the fuel that is delivered in the morning is essentially burned in the afternoon. And so we're very sensitive to leaks and all that goes along with that. And if we had problems with, in the wintertime, say we have a 20 below day or something like that, that effectively would shut down the fleet, the entire fleet, in milliseconds if we start plugging up filters.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that does bring me to my final question for you. As we talk about the cold weather issues with biodiesel, but what is the ideal temperature that you don't experience filter plugging and other issues with the buses and whatnot and the things that you encounter when it's colder?
What's
that ideal temperature?
I'll defer that one to Steve. He's got the
all right. Mr. Chair, Representative. The ideal temperature is actually, in the 70s and the 80s, we absolutely have zero issues or in those types of temperatures. It's at the lower temperatures that we have to do the blending and we have to monitor things a little closer and replace the filters a little bit more frequently.
So maybe 2 to 3 months a year, it's ideal temperature.
At a high level of bio, that would be true. At lower levels of bio, you could.
Thank you. That was because at the high level. So when you take the B20,
right,
you're saying that ideal temperature 70 to 80, these buses will run, not have a problem at all. So, but basically, maybe 2-3 months out a year in Minnesota.
Mr. Carter.
The buses will, as long as the fuel, the cloud point is, at an adequate level, the buses will run fine on B20, April until, September on high levels of bio. The issue is when we go to dispense it into the buses and we run large volumes through a filter, that's when we have the plugging issues and that's when we have the fallout issues.
Due to some of the, basically the temperature requirements, why you heat up to 60, right? 60 degrees.
Mr. Pellegrin.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just so Representative, so we can clarify, when there's a table in our presentation that shows the blends that we use throughout the year. The buses operate satisfactorily at those levels. A few years ago, our engine manufacturer Cummins said had approved B20. So we went to B20 because it's economically advantageous for us to do that. So that's why we bumped up the percentages. When you say the ideal temperature, those are the ideal temperature. We have to reduce the amount of biodiesel as the temperature gets colder, and to avoid those operational issues.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, when Bio 20 becomes a mandate, it looks to me like there's only one window of time that you can use, ideally use it, right? You'll be exempt. There's exemption, correct, during the winter and the colder months?
Right.
Thank you. No further questions.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of questions. What is your month of highest usage?
Gentlemen, whoever wants to take that one.
I can take that, Mr. Chair. The highest level of usage is probably May through the end of September.
Representative Anderson.
So, but the month of September then is one of your high watermark months?
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Pellegrin?
Yeah, maybe, Mr. Chair, if I can clarify, you're talking about the highest month of diesel fuel usage? Is when we do the state fair, because of the fleet, our fleet goes up by about 80 buses in that month. So that's the highest month of consumption of diesel fuel, and we happen to be on B20 when that happens.
Okay. And
Representative Anderson.
The other question that I had is, in these tanks, that you said there's 16 of them, what kind of security do you have around those tanks?
Mr. Carey?
Mr. Chair, the security is through the locked buildings. All the doors and accesses are locked. Our engineering facilities are the only one who has keys and access to those facilities.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Curry, so what kind of backup security plan do you have if there was a terrorist threat against those tanks? And what's kind of your emergency response plan?
Mr. Curry.
I defer that one to you here.
Mr. Chair, Representative, our backup plan is to, if we had something happen at one of our garages, we'd have enough fuel at other garages. We would start fueling buses at other locations. And we also have a service, for example, the North Star trains are actually fueled out of a tanker truck. So we have that option available to us as well to fuel the fleet.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I'd be more interested in kind of if things blew up, what was your emergency response in that direct spot location? I'm sure you probably have that somewhere, and if you can just send it to me, that'd be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Pellegrin. Next on the list, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very quickly following up on the question I had for the Department of Ag for the members of Metro Transit. The number one diesel that you purchase, is it subject to either federal and or state fuel taxes? Just to help refresh the committee on the status on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Pellegrin?
It is not subject to the state tax.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifiers, do you support, and is it your testimony today, that you support the B20 minimum?
Mr. Pellegrin?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we support the B20 minimum as long as the temperature thresholds are maintained that we have today. I could qualify that. As you no doubt assumed from our presentation here, we watch that very closely. You see that we have a table there where we're changing blends on a very regular basis as a result of ambient temperature. And we do that to try to maximize our use of biodiesel. As long as the temperature thresholds are maintained, absolutely.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So thank you for that answer. So I don't understand. Help me understand why you support a mandate up to 20 when currently you found a system to use the number one substitute to bring it down to 2.5%, which sounds like it's working great. But why mandate a higher level in the summer when you're going higher than 20 anyway in the warmer months? And then we're just going to have to be breaking the mandate more in the colder months. What am I missing?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Carr.
Representative. The difference is in the winter time, we are only mandated to use B5. In the summertime is when the mandate moves up to the B20.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry for the interruption, sir, but you just said that you're mandated to use B5 in the winter, but I believe earlier testimony, one of you two gentlemen stated that you don't use B5 in the winter. Is that correct?
Mr. Carey.
Mr. Chair, we do use, we buy 50% number two B5 as required, And the state offers a waiver for the number one. So if you put it into one tank and blended it together, technically you could call that B5. So we are following the state mandate. The reason that we increased the number one is to get that cloud down at a level where our operability is safe and reliable. Our main concern, for example, if we were a trucking industry and we had a bus gel or a truck gel up on the side of the road, you call a service call and you get the truck on, it's maybe a couple hours late. In our industry, if we go down for a couple hours, we have 800 buses on the side of the road. That's a big deal. So we have to really err on the side of caution when we set our blends, and that's why we do it, is for operability.
And Mr. Pellegrin.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the reason we do use the number one fuel primarily is a transit bus does a lot of idling, and when a bus is idling a lot, I mean, they idle at every corner, every stop, and so the number one fuel has a much higher boiling range. It's another component of it, much higher distillation range, and that promotes combustion at idle, at low engine loads. That's why we put the number one in the wintertime. If the ambient temperature is minus 10, we're trying to avoid that fuel dilution that's a normal part of our operation, so we don't dilute the fuel to a high level and wear out our engines faster than normal.
Thank you. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to my understanding, you said technically we're at the 2.5 blend for the winter, which works great, and I think that's a great solution. Mm-hmm. But it just doesn't seem to follow common sense to increase the mandate to 20 just to continue to have waivers when you guys have found a good technical solution to use this product with the appropriate number one to bring it all the way down to 2.5. And I have a hard time understanding why we're saying it needs to be 20%, but for 8 months out of the year, we're going to bring it all the way down to 2.5.
Mr. Kari?
Mr. Chair, it isn't 8 months out of the year. I think it's probably about about three months or 3.5 months out of the year.
Mr. Chair? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, sir, you're saying that there's 12 months, so out of 9 months out of the year, you can use B20?
No, Mr. Chair. No. Yeah, what we do is we wrap it up. We go like to a 70-30 blend where we use, number one at 30%. Then we'll go to a 50 blend. Then we go back down to a B5. So we move it up in the fall, and then we ramp it down in the spring. So there's different levels throughout the year.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So different levels throughout the year, and thank you for, once I found the chart, I appreciate the chart. It's very helpful. So you're saying that you cannot use B20 throughout the entire year?
Mr. Chair, that is absolutely correct.
So why?
Representative.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, sir, why would we want to go to a B20 mandate?
Mr. Kari.
I'll take it.
Mr. Pellegrin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're not suggesting a B20 mandate for the entire year. What we're sharing with you is our experience where we have to keep these blends in order to remain operationally reliable. We ramp up the use of biodiesel when the conditions allow us to do it. That's what we support. We support our fleet reliability. If there's a mandate, I believe the mandate for Minnesota goes into effect in May of 2018 for 20%. We certainly support that with the ambient temperatures that we've outlined in our tables here, and go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Pellegrin. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you support the mandate that's going to go into place in May. But you also support the continued use of the waivers to allow your product to work. And I'm all for bus reliability. That's obviously imperative. Everyone wants that. So it just seems as though if we're not going to be using it year-round, which technically it can't, and we're above 20% throughout the warmer months, as it can go as high as 50 or 60%, as you stated.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to address. The highest level of bio is B20. The 50% is the 50% number one component mixed with the B5 component. So basically, our engine manufacturers don't allow us to go above 20% bio content throughout any part of the year.
And Representative Smith, I think your question might be better for one of the testifiers to come. I think these gentlemen are already using B20 whenever they can for economic reasons, wherever it makes sense weather-wise, regardless of what the mandate is. So, Representative Smith?
Very well, Mr. Chair. Moving on to a different topic, is there a helpline that can be called if there's trouble with the filter?
Mr. Khoury.
Mr. Chair, yes, there is a helpline. The state offers it. Kevin Hennessy, you know, distributes that number. I'm not sure what it is right now. I pretty much call up the Capitol and call up Kevin when I need help.
Is
Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hennessy, is he here today to testify?
He is, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Okay. Next is Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. What is the average age of your buses? Because you mentioned something a little bit ago that you said that your manufacturers had rated your engines for the use of B20. I think it was Cummins. Because I don't think every person that's going to be mandated to use B20 has the luxury of updating buses. So what is your update schedule, and how new are your buses? And what has to happen to buses or other vehicles that might be older to make it so that they can actually run this stuff, if you know?
Mr. Pellegrin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would say the average fleet age of our fleet right now is probably along about 7+ years, something like that. And, you know, my recommendation would be to, you know, get with the engine manufacturers and say what is tolerable in terms of, you know, B20. But it's been a few years ago that Cummins did come out and say that B20 was acceptable. There are many transit. Many of my peers around the country also run B20 and only B20 in the summertime. They don't blend it or anything like you're seeing here that we do. But older engines. I think we spoke earlier about the locomotives. My North Star locomotives. I can't run B20 in the North Star locomotives because they have what's called a unit injector. It's old technology. They would plug up pretty fast. We've done some experiments with it, and others have done some experiments. That old technology couldn't accommodate the B20.
Representative Nash?
Mr. Chair, thanks. That's good for now. Maybe we can find from somebody along the line how many other older vehicles are out there and how many of them would be affected. I don't know who we'd ask for that, but that'd be a great question to...
If somebody that's coming down in the future that wants to answer that, that would be great. And Representative Hillstrom's next, but I have one quick question. Do you guys contact, or do people contact you from other transit agencies around the country to get your experience with this, your expertise?
Mr. Chair? Yes, they do. Okay. Other industries have done that. Garbage industries have called. Other transits have. Chicago, for example.
Cincinnati, St. Louis. We have a American Public Transit. We actually have a maintenance committee where this subject is discussed in brutal detail.
More brutal than Thank that. You. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have to be in another conference committee in 8 minutes. So rather than asking a bunch of questions, I'm just going to make a statement. Know that this is an important issue to Minnesotans, and then I'm going to have to go. So it isn't that I want to hit and run. I just want to make certain that I get these items on the record before I go. Members, biodiesel really does help reduce particulate matter, hydrocarbons, sulfur dioxide, and other toxins that are in the air that impact human health. And the biodiesel industry has had an incredibly positive impact for Minnesota farmers. I have been a long supporter of biodiesel. With 300 million bushels of soybean grown in Minnesota each year, it's roughly $200 million to Minnesota farmers every year. Now, the Minnesota Farmers Union have also sent a letter saying that the target to move from B10 to B20 in 2018 is important, and they oppose any delays to this timeline, and that the boost to rural economy by using this commodity also allows us to not be dependent on imported petroleum. So, members, Minnesota has long been a leader in this area. We should continue to be that leader. I know very well that folks have known that this is coming, and we have the ability to say during cold winter months, folks have the ability to use the alternatives of what works. There is no reason to not allow the people who sit at the table to make decisions about whether or not the Minnesota economy and Minnesota industry is ready for this mandate. It has been the law for a long time. And members, I think that simply having the hearing to say, well, you're not using it all year, is not really that relevant because they're not required to use it all year. Clearly, there's an economic benefit to using this alternative, both for the user and for Minnesota's economy. And so I'm a strong supporter of biofuels, and I believe that we should not take our eye off the ball. And with that, Mr. Chair, I have to be in another committee.
Representative Hillstrom, as always, nicely done. It's been a pleasure having you on the committee, and we're not going to talk about you when you leave.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, for letting me sit here and ask a question. Testifiers, you did talk about the economic value of B20. Could you elaborate on that? Is it cheaper costs, better mileage, less maintenance on your engines? Why do you say it's more economical?
Mr. Chair, the economics, the product is actually subsidized on a federal level. They have a RIN value and also a tax credit. Well, you add that into the area, subtract that from the production costs, and it's slightly less than the petroleum diesel as a whole. So that lesser cost offers us the economic value. As well, because of our operations, it doesn't reduce our, it has slightly less energy BTUs. It's similar to like number one fuel, although we haven't seen a lot or hardly any reduction in fuel mileage. So we gain by the price, and we don't lose fuel mileage by using the product.
Representative Anderson? Representative Fenton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. Maybe perhaps you can answer, since you do deal with, you've had calls from these other states, what are the mandate requirements in North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin?
I'm not aware of what they are. I couldn't answer that.
I'll ask somebody else who comes down, perhaps.
We have a tough time keeping up blending our own stuff, so.
If we see one of your buses in Fargo, we'll know something's going on. Representative Kusha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. And I apologize, I've been following this and listening, but there's so much going on, it's not top of my mind. But as I'm listening, here's my big question. Why do we care? What if the mandate goes away? It sounds like with all the things going on in the market, I mean, how much of this would get taken care of? It sounds like providers would be able to get to their own levels. I mean, why do we need this mandate? I'm trying to figure out everything I keep hearing, economics, market, all these other, what if the mandate were to just go away? Could we get to acceptable levels? What's the big deal here?
Gentlemen, has the Met Council taken a position on this?
Good.
I thought that'd be funnier.
I'm laughing internally.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, I'm Judd Shannon. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council, and the Council has not taken a position on that. We work through the administration. We were here today to give a kind of a update on how we use the biodiesel fuel in our fleet, but I'd be happy to circle back with you, but that's not a question that we came prepared to respond to today, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Shannon. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if the mandate went away, the world wouldn't blow up? Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Chair and Representative,
it's okay, we're all friends, so you can just say it.
we'll be happy to circle back with you. Representative, I think, that's a big, broad question, and it's just the Council hasn't weighed in on the mandate. I know that's something that the legislature and this committee is spending a lot of time talking about, and we're happy to talk to you about the performance of the fuels in our system, but the broader policy questions are questions that I don't expect Mr. Pellegrin and Mr. Kari to respond to today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, gentlemen, I guess probably most of our focus from a legislative perspective has been on the rural, the agricultural aspects, and people growing it and using it, and this has been really interesting and enlightening hearing from you two, so thank you. And Representative Smith, I think you've got our last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the gentleman, yes. Could you come back, please? Thank you. You just stated that the Met Council has not weighed in yet on a position, and this mandate is going to be coming into place shortly, within a matter of days. When will the Met Council state an opinion on this particular issue? When can we expect that?
Mr. Shetland. Mr. Chair, Representative, the Council operates under current law, and so I think that how we are expecting the mandate to operate the way that it is currently set to be engaged. But again, this is a bigger, broader question that that the legislature and the administration are dealing with. So I'm not sure the council is going to weigh in on that. That's probably a better question for the administration or the Department of Agriculture.
Short follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. So you said previously that the Met Council has not weighed in on it yet. Now you just stated, if I can summarize, that the Met Council will not weigh in on it. Which answer are you going to go with, sir?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure. I think that it is a question that we're going to speak with the administration about. Hopefully that satisfies your question.
Mr. Chair, so it's a third answer. Either you said you were going to weigh in, then you said you're going to do it in the future, and now you're not sure. And I understand you're just the messenger this morning, but a message to the Met Council, they should figure that out.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, the council came again this morning to talk about the performance of biodiesel as part of our system. We are the largest user of this type of fuel in the country, and we were happy to explain to the committee how it works. We were not prepared to come and talk about the effects of the mandate and how that was going to affect our system. And I'm sorry if I've given you three different answers, but the fact is I don't have an answer for you on that.
One last question. Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps you might want to stay up there in case you need to answer this, but what are you going to do? I think the number one exemption goes away in 2020, so what will you do when that goes away? What are the plans? Have you already been planning for it, and what does that include?
Mr. Curry?
Mr. Chair, Representative. I'm hoping the exemption is continued beyond 2020. If it doesn't, we can use cold flow improver to help out with those situations. We can make it by without the exemption, but the exemption actually makes our cold weather operability and our buses actually idle and run better. So I would hope that they would consider that and provide an extension.
So you're looking for an exemption, and because essentially that would raise the cost as well of what you have to do, correct? Of the upkeep of what you need to do?
The chair, Mr. Chair, Representative, the cost would actually go down slightly because the number one component is more expensive than the number two, the five. Although it's the operability and the idling and the other factors that come into play.
So you're clear. I mean, is that one of the stated opinions of the then is that are you going to come to the legislature, whoever you need to go to get that exemption?
Mr. Carr or Mr. Pellegrin?
Mr. Chair, Representative, these are very technical issues. I mean, we look at fuel chemistry very carefully. We operate nearly 1,000 buses, and the idle emissions and the effects of fuel dilution, those kinds of things that we have seen, it's been our experience, is the reason we are here today and why we blend this the way it is today. Now, if the number one exemption goes away, we will have to evaluate what that does to how it contaminates our lube oil and all the other maintenance issues, how flood, how fast it will plug oil filters, and other secondary things that we haven't talked about here today. So it will have an effect. The magnitude of, we're not sure because we haven't done it. But we know that the reason that we use a number one fuel, I mean, transit buses use a number one fuel. We're probably exclusively using a number one fuel. It's more like Jet A is the number one fuel we get because of the amount of idling we do. Highway trucks and other, you know, diesel engines don't operate the same way as we do. So we have to look at it specifically in our operation, temperatures, all those things, and make an assessment, an evaluation of what that would do.
Thank you, gentlemen. Very interesting presentation. And with that, we're going to go on to Mr. Webb from Flint Hills Resources. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning.
Testimony.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, can you hear me all right? My name is Brett Webb. I'm Director of Commercial Development for Flint Hills Resources. Flint Hills Resources is a leading refining and biofuels company based in Wichita, Kansas. Our refining operations include the Pine Bend Refinery in Rosemount, Minnesota, which supplies roughly 50% of the transportation fuels used in Minnesota and a significant portion of the fuels used in the surrounding states. We're also a major producer of biofuels, including both ethanol and biodiesel, with operations primarily in Iowa and Nebraska. As both a petroleum refiner and a biofuel producer, Flint Hills Resources strives to maintain the highest degree of consumer confidence in the quality and reliability of the fuels the driving public depends on. We're also a member of the Minnesota Biodiesel Task Force, which, under the leadership of the Department of Agriculture, has sought to ensure the prudent integration of biodiesel into Minnesota's fuel supply consistent with state law. We greatly appreciate the department's leadership in this area. But we do have some concerns with the recent report that suggests the state may be prepared to move forward with the B20 mandate next spring. The move to B20 would double the existing blending requirement and put Minnesota in uncharted territory. No other state has mandated the use of biodiesel anywhere near this level. In fact, other than possibly Costa Rica, we believe no other jurisdiction anywhere in the world requires motorists to use this amount of biodiesel, regardless of economic factors or other practical considerations. We're concerned that moving forward with B20 next spring could prove harmful to Minnesota businesses and consumers and potentially erode confidence in the fuels that Flint Hills produces and markets, including biodiesel. We believe some of the required statutory conditions for mandating B20, as well as several practical issues, also remain unresolved. For example, very few, if any, of the fuel terminals that serve Minnesota are expected to have the tanks and blending infrastructure in place that are needed to efficiently distribute B20. Absent this equipment, Minnesota could see more product outages, particularly during peak agriculture demand seasons, could see longer wait times for loading and delivery of fuel, higher costs for trucking as fuel has to be delivered from further distances. In addition to infrastructure, it's not clear the necessary regulatory structures in place to ensure B20 compliance, including adequate enforcement resources. With higher blends, there's more potential for error and potentially more incentive to dismiss the mandate when biofuel economics are ever unfavorable. We also question whether there is adequate supply of locally produced biodiesel to meet the statutory requirement needed to justify increasing the mandate to the next level of B20. Our analysis suggests there would only be enough biodiesel production capacity in Minnesota to meet roughly a third of the average daily demand required for B20. The statute requires that to be 50%. Some of this production also that's produced in Minnesota leaves the state and goes to other states. Cold weather remains a potential issue as well. Although the cold weather performance of biodiesel has improved, the vast majority of biodiesel available in the marketplace today is still susceptible to cold weather issues, and it's likely, in particular, the months of April and September in Minnesota could simply be too cold for the higher biodiesel blends without the use of specialized equipment. Vehicle engine warranties also remain a concern. While B20 is an acceptable consumer choice under the right conditions, not all diesel engine manufacturers cover higher diesel blends in their engine warranties. Forcing consumers to purchase B20 could void warranties for some Minnesota consumers who own light-duty diesel vehicles. Older vehicles, some farm equipment that's more than a few years old are also not warranted to run on diesel blends above V5. Finally, the economics of biodiesel are presently very uncertain. The $1 per gallon federal tax credit has expired. It expired at the beginning of this year. It may not be restored. The federal renewable fuel standard also may undergo changes under the new administration, which could affect the net cost of biodiesel. Today, biodiesel typically costs between $1.75 to $2 per gallon more than straight clear diesel fuel. At times, the difference has exceeded $3 per gallon. At B20, Minnesota would be exposed more than the rest of the country to possible changes in federal law that could result in dramatically higher biodiesel and diesel prices for the state. In closing, we believe biofuels, including biodiesel, can compete in the marketplace without the need for escalating mandates. Higher biodiesel blends, including B20, are already available in the marketplace, and they're being chosen freely by consumers when cost and seasonal factors make it a competitive and practical option. We encourage the state to let the marketplace continue to work, or to at least pause until it's clear that all the statutory conditions and the practical considerations for B20 have been met or resolved. We appreciate the committee's time and interest in this important matter and the opportunity to provide these comments. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Webb. Representative Nash has a question. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is regarding infrastructural upgrades that you might have to make to both manufacture and deliver B20. I'm sure you've calculated those. How significant are they? And then the second part of my question is, what is the expected ROI for B20 upgrade, and what was the ROI schedule for B10 upgrade? So a couple questions in there.
So the majority of the investments will need to be made at the pipeline terminal level. Flint Hills Resources has very limited distribution terminals in the state. We primarily use the Magellan pipeline system. I believe Magellan is going to speak to this issue a little bit more today and can probably give you more specific answers. I will say that the costs, generally what this looks like is additional storage tanks and upgrading of the blending infrastructure so the biodiesel could be blended accurately and quickly, efficiently into the trucks. And this can run in the millions of dollars per terminal, potentially. Again, Flint Hills Resources owns a very limited amount of terminals in Minnesota, so it's really more of an issue for the pipelines that we use and are concerned about those terminals not having the infrastructure in place, perhaps, but that won't be our investment to make directly. The cost of those investments, however they're made, would ultimately get passed on and paid for by consumers because it'll just raise costs.
And Madam Chair?
Yes.
Perhaps when the next testifier comes down, I think from Magellan, they could answer those questions in their testimony. I'd appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Fenton has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here to testify today. Since you seem to be a supplier, do you know anything about the mandates in the states that surround Minnesota?
Mr. Webb?
Chairman and Representative, there are no other mandates in the surrounding states. Minnesota is the only state that we market in this region that has a biodiesel mandate.
So, thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Redd. So that could have a profound economic impact, could it not? I mean, is there people could go purchase in bulk across state line? Is that accurate?
Mr. Webb?
Chairman, Representative. Yes, I mean, the issue will really come into play in times when the economics fluctuate and at times when biodiesel is not economic and people are free to choose. I would assume they're going to, you know, be free to go find the lowest cost diesel fuel that they can get.
Okay. Thank you. No further questions.
Mr. Webb?
Any other questions for members? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Hine from Magellan. I believe there he is.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Hine, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Hine. I represent Magellan Midstream Partners, and we own and operate petroleum pipelines and distribution terminals here in Minnesota and throughout the middle part of the country, and I'll show you a graphic in a moment to highlight that. The image that you see behind me is of above-ground storage tanks. I'll show you a more detailed graphic of our facility here in Roseville, Minnesota, in just a moment. But when I refer to a petroleum terminal, it is generally one that is fed inbound by pipeline, meaning gasoline, diesel, comes into the terminal by pipeline and stored in these above-ground storage tanks. I would also tell you that it's a privilege for our company to do business in the state of Minnesota. We're pleased to be here. We've been here for a long, long time and have aspirations to stay for many years to come. So we are an independent voice, and what I mean by that is we're not affiliated or owned by any refiner or any other major stakeholder. We have some 170,000 individual investors that buy and sell Magellan units every day on the New York Stock Exchange. Prior to today, we have indeed met with each agency, the Department of Commerce, the Department of Agriculture, and the Department of Pollution Control, to discuss our issues associated with the increase from B10 to B20 as required by the statute. As it relates to today and the testimony that you heard from the Department of Agriculture and their report submitted to the legislature, one area that the report did not include was a discussion on infrastructure. And the statute does indeed have a provision that requires adequate blending infrastructure to be in place prior to the implementation of the B20 requirement. So to build the case of why we hope to leave you with the impression that we do have standing to speak about the issues today, we have 10,000 miles of petroleum pipelines throughout the United States. You can see that our focus is primarily in the Midwestern part of the country, from Texas north, and then terminating up in Grand Forks, North Dakota. It's the nation's longest refined products pipeline system. We own and operate 53 terminals that are connected to that system, another 27 petroleum terminals over in the southeastern United States connected to other third-party pipelines. So as you look at Magellan and you think of us, we're a company that owns pipelines and distribution terminals. We don't own the products that we transport through those terminals. Our customers include refiners, petroleum marketers, and renewable fuel producers and marketers. So we have a wide range of different companies that we provide services for. And I would also add that we're connected to over 50% of the nation's refining capacity. Some 13 refineries, including the one referenced by Mr. Webb just a moment ago, are directly connected to Magellan's pipeline, along with a number of other third-party pipelines that connect into us. So some of the gasoline and diesel fuel that is brought into our system here in Minnesota could be produced and refined as far away as the Gulf Coast of Texas and brought in from the south. Of course, we bring in lots of product from in-state refineries as well. So focusing on the assets that we have here in the state, the distribution terminals that are connected to our pipeline system include Alexandria, Mankato, Marshall, Minneapolis, which is Roseville, Rochester, and Renshaw. So we have six terminals in the state. Approximately 50% of the fuel consumed in the state flows through our pipelines and is distributed from our petroleum distribution terminals. We're not currently shipping biodiesel or biodiesel blends in our pipeline system, and the same is true for ethanol. All of the biodiesel blended at our terminals is in above-ground storage tanks, which I'll provide you a graphic of that to show you what an insulated tank will look like. Our first investment in biodiesel infrastructure was made back in 2004 in Alexandria. I would also tell you that out of the 85 terminals that we own and operate, virtually all of them have the ability to store and blend ethanol, anywhere from E10 up to E85, different blends that we offer. 13 of our terminals, primarily here in the northern tier of the country, have biodiesel blending capabilities. So let me give you an image of a petroleum and renewable fuel distribution terminal. The aerial graphic that you see is our facility in Roseville. You can see that there are a number of above-ground storage tanks varying in size and a significant investment to maintain these types of assets. There's an individual tank that is on the right. Some of these tanks are 80 to 100,000 barrels in size. When you compare that to a biodiesel tank, our biodiesel tanks are generally 2,000 barrels in size. And I'll go into that in just a moment. The biodiesel and ethanol that we receive primarily comes inbound by truck. In Roseville, we also receive ethanol by rail, but that's almost an anomaly to us. The majority of it comes in by truck. Earlier today, there were some questions regarding biodiesel storage and heating from the Metro Transit Authority. And this is a graphic of our biodiesel tank in Roseville. And this is very typical to what you would see in Alexandria or Mankato or Marshall or Rochester or in Renshaw. Typically a 2,000-barrel tank that is insulated. The lines from the tank to the truck loading facility, and I'll show you a graphic of that in a moment, are insulated and also heated. Unlike the Metro Transit Authority, our systems are charged by electric. And we obviously have a cost of keeping the product heated to 60 degrees, but it's been our experience that that is the best way to blend biodiesel into diesel fuel, regardless of the temperature of the diesel fuel, when the biodiesel is kept at 60 degrees, even through the coldest of months in the winter. So beyond the six terminals that I've mentioned to you, we also installed biodiesel blending infrastructure in Fargo and Grand Forks, which are on the western border of the state, and also in Mason City, Iowa, on the southern, south of the southern border of the state. One of the best ways to blend biodiesel from our perspective, Magellan's been doing this now for some 13 years. Above and beyond that, we have a world-class renewable fuels laboratory that we own and operate in Kansas City. It has been the predominant testing facility for both biodiesel and ethanol for generations. The way that we have become most comfortable in blending biodiesel from a quality standpoint is to use a ratio system. There are several ways to blend biodiesel into diesel fuel. Let me briefly explain. A ratio blending system operates to where if the driver asks for a B5 load and there's a 1,000-gallon compartment in the truck, the 95% diesel fuel is also injected simultaneously with 5% diesel fuel throughout the entire blend. That helps ensure the integrity of the blend from the top, the middle, and the bottom once it's loaded into the truck and ultimately dropped at the truck stop or service station. The blend doesn't fall out of suspension when it's blended correctly. It's expensive to do it that way. We've made the capital investment to put biodiesel ratio blending systems in because our customers expect us to do that. This is the right way to do it when you're concerned about quality. Speaking of quality, we have a quality control program that goes into place for our biodiesel as well. And we deal directly with biodiesel producers that send us various samples, and we take samples of various trucks coming in and do full-scale laboratory analysis to make sure that the biodiesel we receive and add into our tank, our fungible tank, meets all of those specifications. So let me boil this down and provide you an image of our truck loading rack. This is Roseville. This was a photo that was taken randomly at 10 a.m. in the morning earlier this week. As mentioned, over half of the fuel in the state flows through our system and is distributed from our terminals. We don't have adequate blending infrastructure for B20 today. We have adequate infrastructure to accommodate B10, B5, or B2.5, as mentioned by the Metro Transit Authority. We can do all of that. We don't have the infrastructure to double the capacity from 10 to 20%. I know there's those in the audience that would say, well, you've known about this for several years, so why haven't you done it? A company like us builds the services to meet the needs of our customers. And so far, we've had no one come to us willing to make a commitment to help us underwrite the investment of approximately $2 million per terminal, times 6 in Minnesota, times 2 in North Dakota, and times 1 in Iowa that we would need to invest in. So we're looking at approximately a $20 million investment to have our systems adequate for B20. That means that we need to increase our storage capacity. That means that we need to increase our capacity at the loading racks to inject as much as 20% biodiesel. And we don't have that today. So what it means is if the mandate goes into effect, what we would be able to do is to, instead of taking 15 to 20 minutes to load a truck, it would take double that. And that means that there would be an economic consequence not only to the truck drivers but to the state. And from our perspective, that's a clear indication that biodiesel infrastructure is not adequate. Our customers tell us that they lack certainty to help make those commitments to us. The uncertainty includes the lack of the biodiesel tax credit on the federal side, uncertainty beyond 2018 on the RFS, and uncertainty on who will be the obligated party of the renewable fuel standard. So we need time for these things to settle out, these variables to settle out, to put our customers in a position that they're willing to make commitments and help us make the investment. The majority of the fuels throughout the country, the high majority, are all, and renewable fuels, are all blended at the terminal rack. We don't have the capability of doing that in this case. So I'll be happy to address any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Hine. Members, any questions? Representative Anderson has a question.
Mr. Hine, did the Department of Agriculture or the Department of Commerce reach out to you and ask if you had the capacity to do this at all?
Mr. Hine.
Mr. Chairman and members, Representative, we met with both of those agencies recently to inform them of exactly what I just told you. But as far as having any proactive communication, I don't recall that.
Representative Anderson.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hine, just to be clear, so prior to them saying we're going to go ahead and do this B20, they never had a conversation with you guys?
Mr. Hine.
I don't recall any conversation.
Okay, thank you.
Members, any other questions? Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hine, earlier I had asked a question about investment and ROI. Can you address the ROI of the investment that you're going to have to make, and both for the last iteration of B10 and what it would look like for the schedule for B20?
Mr. Hine.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we did not need to make any additional investments for B10. When we installed the blending infrastructure, the storage and the pumping capacity and the systems that I showed you here, as far as the mechanical devices and the sophistication of those ratio blending systems, they were all sized and capable of handling B10 and anything under B10. The jump from B10 to B20 would require additional storage and blending infrastructure at the truck loading rack. And the way that we're looking at that investment is very similar to the way that we would look at building a new pipeline or adding other blending infrastructure. It would need to meet an internal rate of return. And I don't have that number exactly at my fingertip, but I'll be happy to provide it for you. But that is the key for us, is making those investments comes with commitments from our customers. And today we don't have any of that for this case.
Representative Anderson P.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, the decision has not been made yet to increase to B20. The three departments have to sign off on that, and they're in the process of that right now. So that decision has not been made yet. But just a quick question for the testifier. You say you don't have the capacity to handle B20. How does the Met Transit Authority get B20 now, and how do you handle somebody ordering a load of B20?
Mr. Hine.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the Metropolitan Transit Authority has their own blending system, as I understand it. So they would take diesel fuel and number one oil from our terminals or other terminals in the state and then blend that with biodiesel at their own location. So they can correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I thought that's what they were explaining. In our case, if you wanted a B20 blend, we are physically capable of loading B20. However, if it were a wide scale such as a statewide requirement, we don't have the capacity to do that, which is what I tried to explain.
Thank you. Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may know the answer to this, but perhaps the agencies might need to answer this as well. But when I went back and looked at some of the testimony when we started to move in this direction, I think it was the Department of Agriculture that testified, you know, one of the main reasons for moving toward biodiesel blends was to help move toward an energy the U.S. energy independence. And I think it was mentioned here, reduce the reliance on foreign oil. But since then, a lot has changed in the area of energy across the spectrum. So I guess my question is, have all the stakeholders had a discussion in any of these meetings with the increase in domestic oil production? If you reevaluated if this is a dire need right now, has that discussion taken place?
Mr. Hunt.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, thank you for the question. And the way I'll address this is from a perspective of Magellan uniquely, and that is we're indifferent on the type of fuels that we transport, we store, and we distribute, which is why we offer such a wide variety of different services for our customers, both with ethanol and biodiesel, and with petroleum products, obviously, that we transport by pipeline. But our nature is generally not to get involved in debates or policy questions regarding the merits of one fuel over another. And I'm certainly not here today to testify in any way against the merits of B20. I'm here to address the lack of infrastructure, which is a statutory requirement that needs to be triggered 270 days prior to the mandatory requirement. And with a company that's 50% of the supply in the state as it relates to storage and distribution telling you that the infrastructure is not there, I would hope that one of the takeaways you have today is we do indeed have the standing to be able to make that statement.
Mr. Hine, thank you very much. I think next, Mr. Roth from the Petroleum Institute.
I have a follow-up.
Representative Fenton has a very brief follow-up question.
Thank you. As you talk about infrastructure, somebody is responsible for signing off and saying, yep, we're good to go. We have the infrastructure to support this. Who would that be here in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair and Representative, that would be the three commissioners from Department of Commerce and Agriculture and Pollution Control Agency. And I would also say that we do have ongoing conversations with all of these agencies in various parts of our company, And for me personally, the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Commerce have been outstanding agencies to work with as it relates to a wide variety of different issues.
And Mr. Chair, I hope we do hear from them, and I have concerns, and I'd like to hear if they would be ready to sign off with the infrastructure.
Representative Fenton, I think what we're going to do is hear from Mr. Roth, and then somebody from the Department of Agriculture wants to come back up and talk about some of these issues, that would be great. Mr. Roth, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Aaron Roth. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota-Wisconsin Petroleum Council, which is a part of the American Petroleum Institute based in Washington, D.C. Magellan is a member, so I'm going to be very brief. We have other members who have terminal facilities inside and outside of Minnesota, including NuStar Energy, which has a big facility right by Magellan's Roseville facility. BP also supplies fuel into the state from Iowa, and there are a number of other independent terminal operators, for instance, Calumet Specialties up in Superior, Wisconsin, the old Murphy refinery, supplies a ton of diesel fuel to northeastern Minnesota from where I'm at, or come from, Itasca County. To Representative Fenton's question earlier about surrounding states and biodiesel mandates, there are no surrounding states that mandate biodiesel. To my knowledge, there's only one state in the union that mandates statewide, and that's New Mexico, and that's a B5 mandate. There are states that, like Illinois, Washington, that have a tax incentive for certain blends, but Minnesota is really an island, even today with B10. And if we go to B20, it just exacerbates the problem. So my industry and members that provide fuels, diesel fuel, are not opposed at all to the use of biodiesel, ethanol. But again, I heard it before, we believe in the marketplace deciding and not in mandates. One of the concerns I've heard from the retail gasoline suppliers in the state is, if you have a trucking firm, for instance, Schneider National, which is one of the largest trucking firms out of Green Bay, and you're trucking goods and services from Wisconsin to South Dakota, if you're not interested in using B20 in the summertime, why wouldn't you refuel in Hudson, Wisconsin, or Fargo, North Dakota? That's a consumer choice, and that's what I'm talking about, the marketplace. It could have an adverse effect. The mandate could have an adverse effect on gasoline and diesel retailers in Minnesota. The other big concern we have as an industry is warranties. I can't speak for the Automobile Manufacturers Association, but many diesel engines are not warrantied above B5. And so our concern as an industry, if you're ExxonMobil and a person misfuels and then has a huge problem with their engine, they're going to go back to ExxonMobil to fix the problem, not to the retailer. So I think that's a huge issue that needs to be discussed further. I come from Itasca County and small towns around Grand Rapids like Bovee, Coleraine, and Cohasset. Their fire equipment is not brand new, and there could be a concern with first responder equipment around the state, especially in greater Minnesota. So I think there's a lot of questions that need to be asked and answered as we move forward, and that's why we think it behooves the agencies to take a close look at not implementing the mandate next May. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chair, and if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Roth. I'm not seeing any, and we've got Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the opportunity.
Are you on this committee?
No, I'm not.
Okay,
may I ask a question?
Oh, go ahead. I'm getting
okay. Thanks for the opportunity to sit here, and I'm learning a lot. I represent a lot of soybean growers, so this is an important issue. My question is, and I don't know if you're able to answer it, why hasn't there been an effort to ramp up the storage facilities and the terminals, given that the mandate is currently in law?
Mr. Ross. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I think if you heard Mr. Hines' testimony, it's kind of like the chicken and the egg. Terminal operators and pipelines are shippers. They don't own the product. So they need, when they have to put further infrastructure in the ground, they need somebody up front to agree to help pay for that cost. And to this point, from the members I have with API in the state and just outside the state, they don't have that guarantee that somebody's going to come forward to help pay for that infrastructure. So it's kind of like a chicken and the egg.
Representative Johnson, you're good.
That's it.
Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you refresh my memory about when this mandate went into effect?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I got transported to Madison, Wisconsin back in 1998 from Minnesota. So I wasn't here when it actually passed, but I think and Mr. Hine would know for sure, but I think it's 2010? 2005.
Okay, 2005.
But it's been pushed back at least once before.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then it seems to me we're not necessarily an island, but perhaps ahead of the curve.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. And with that,
Slocum.
I was thinking Hillstrom because she made a nice statement before earlier, and I was going to comment on that, but then I lost track of myself. Ms. Wobble, if you want to come back, we also had a request from a committee member for Mr. Hennessy, if he's here from the Department of Agriculture. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll be quick, so I know there's a few others who want to speak. There's a couple of things that I just wanted to address since my testimony. One thing is I just want to reiterate what Representative Anderson said, that, again, the decision has not been made at this point. We will have a biodiesel task force meeting in June 9th, 2017. There is precedence for waiting and delaying if the infrastructure is not there for B10. We did put a pause on the mandate until there was proper blending infrastructure in the southwest part of the state. So we feel very confident in the process that is set in place and how this statute is written. So I just wanted to reiterate again that the decision has not yet been made, and we will very much get the input of all stakeholders involved before any decision is made. I also just want to say that I was mistaken. We did have another meeting in the spring of 2015 to discuss signage with the Biodiesel Task Force. So, again, just to reiterate that we do meet with those folks when necessary, and we do solicit input on these important issues as things come up with biodiesel.
Thank you, Ms. Wobble. And Mr. Hennessy, if you want to go ahead.
My name is Kevin Hennessy. I'm the bioenergy manager at the Department of Agriculture.
We're happy to have you here. Welcome to the committee.
Since December 5th of 2011, if you're wondering, which is, I just want to add for the record that I've been writing this report. This is my sixth year, and I was really worried that nobody was reading it, so thanks for all the attention you're giving to this report.
Well, I think I speak for the whole committee. This has really been interesting. I mean, the whole process leading up to it and today, I mean, clearly you can tell by the amount of questions people are interested in it, so thank you. Members, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know which one of you could answer this question. I'm just looking through all the different materials, and I apologize I missed your testimony. I've had several conflicts today at the same time. But based upon what I have been able to glean so far, it doesn't sound like we're ready for that to move forward with the next step. And I guess my biggest concern that I have is kind of how you determine things. And I'm looking at your packet here, and it talks about kind of the nameplate capacity. Can you talk to me a little bit about how you reach the 54% threshold, what data you're including as part of that?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Hennessy?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm sorry, I didn't see your name, but, and I didn't study my book well enough before I got here. I use EIA data, that's the Energy Information Administration's data, from national, and then what we do is we take all the sectors, we break it down by the sectors that actually are required to blend biodiesel in the state, and it's always a year behind, so it's 2015 data that this year's report was based on. I've used annual capacity, annual numbers for diesel usage in the state. No one has ever questioned that until this year, and if they would have questioned it, I'd be happy. I love to analyze things. Ask anyone. I mean, you might be sorry you even asked that question in about 2 minutes, but
I'm married to a science teacher.
All right. Well, I was a science teacher, so there you go. So I could go more into the details, but I don't really think we have time here right now. But, you know, I mean, the questions that we've been posed by Magellan is annualized basis versus annual basis, and that's something I've started doing analysis on, but I don't know if it's even really relevant to the statute. So I really want to step back. I mean, my job is, you know, I'm a state worker, okay? I'm not making policy like you guys are. I'm just putting this report together as best I can. I solicit information from everyone. The statute asks for information to be submitted by all biodiesel task force members by January 1st. So if they send me something, I put it in Appendix A. Okay, and they're welcome to call me before that. They're also welcome to request a biodiesel task force meeting at any time, but no one has. So.
Thank you, Mr. Hennessy. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hennessy, you seem like you feel like you've been through the ringer today. That's not my intent. I appreciate you coming forward today, and I appreciate your willingness to look at this differently, because as a science teacher, former science teacher, you understand that data does make a huge difference and can skew some results. So I think for my purposes and just looking at this overall, I'm really concerned about the overall supply. I don't want Minnesota to get into a situation where we have a shortage, because as lawmakers, you know who gets blamed for that? We do. We get blamed for all that stuff, and I don't want to have a situation where we have to have a special session in the fall because we're facing a severe shortage in fuel. And I'm sure you guys, just let me finish, please. I'm sure you guys don't want to experience that either, because it makes your lives more challenging too, because then you have to come back to committees like this, and then it's not fun at all. So I guess I think it would be helpful for me if you can go back and do the data, not based on annualized, but based on the actual months that this fuel would be used, because I think that that would be helpful for us, just to see it from that perspective. And then also I'd like to have a greater conversation with the department about how we address fuel shortages overall, because I don't want to see that happen. I understand that in some circumstances we do a splash method. I'm concerned about what kind of impact that would have on vehicles. Will that cause clogging? And then who is left holding the bag? Because then there will be a lawsuit. And so then is the state liable for it? Is the retailer liable for it? Is the fuel supplier liable for that? At the end of the day, I'm concerned that that will eventually, we all pay for it in higher consumer costs and things of that nature. So can I get your commitment that you're going to be looking at this not from an annualized basis, but the actual months that are being used?
Ms. Wall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, so I just want to be clear as well that there is, it's very specific in the law as written, that if that there isn't a proper supply to meet the mandate, that the Commissioner of Commerce, without legislative interference, can put a pause on the mandate. So we wouldn't have to come back for a special session or anything like that if there wasn't proper supply in place. I would say that we feel very strongly that the law, we interpret the law and the intent of the law to be that that supply is an average over the year. So that's how we interpret the law and feel that it should be implemented, and that was the intent as written. And so that's the basis that we base some of those decisions on. I would also say that we will be hearing all of the information at those biodiesel task force meeting from all sides of this issue. So we'll make sure that folks that are in the field doing these things, blending, and the folks who who are running the plants and all of that can have a chance to get their say in before any decision is made by all three agencies.
Representative Anderson.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Wobble, well, I would recommend that the commissioner not go by the annual basis. I think that it should be based off of just the months because that does truly skew your results. So if you're being honest about how we're going through with this process, I think that it should be based just on the months that it's actually being used. And from a science perspective, I'm sure Mr. Hennessy can understand that that's why you don't want to skew the results. And, you know, I remember when, you know, Representative Junkie, he was kind of the nickname that they had for him. But
I had a nickname for him, but I can't repeat that.
good guy from my hometown area. And when he was pushing for this change in the law, the concern was making sure that we had the infrastructure in place. That was point number three. And so I do think that we really need to be mindful that we can actually make this happen, that it's doable, that it's the right thing to do, and that it's not going to have an exorbitant price on the consumers. Representative Nash has mentioned that a couple of times. I'm very concerned about that piece because that costs the folks in Minnesota a lot of money. So I think that that should be part of the factors. And though we have things in current law, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't make some adjustments based upon what we've learned from the past, too, and going forward. And I think Representative Anderson would probably be willing to look at that as well because we want to make sure that it works properly. You know, so I think that that's the concerns that I have. And on the shortage end of things, I know that the commissioner, you said, can make those adjustments. But my concern is what are they adding on top? Does that lead to clogging? How it pays for that at the end of the day, and are we opening ourselves or at least other businesses here in the state of Minnesota to lawsuit for something that is completely outside of their control? So that's it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. And members, I think what we'll do is we'll let Representative Smith ask a couple of questions, and then we've got three or four more people on the list that we want to get up and testify, and we'll let Ms. Wobble escape. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hennessy, the diesel helpline, is that part of your organization, or does that part of your structure?
Mr. Hennessy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, is that correct?
Smith.
The biodiesel helpline is independently run. I just give out their number. They're not part of the Department of Agriculture.
Representative Spence.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So who is the person that handles those calls, or what is the name of that company that handles that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith. It's the MegCorp, and it is a free service to anyone who would send in a sample, for example, or have questions. There's not a charge.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is there a contract in place between the department and this MEG Corp?
Mr. Hennessy. Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, no.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hennessy. Nice job. Nice reports. We appreciate that. Ms. Wobble, excellent job as well. Thank you very much. And with that, I think we'll move to Renewable Energy Group, Mr. Christensen and Mr. West. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourselves for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Ted West. I'm with Renewable Energy Group from the Albert Lee facility in southern Minnesota. I am proud to be a resident of Minnesota. I was born in Minnesota. I've been a resident of Minnesota my whole life. Even when I was in the U.S. military and the Navy, I was technically a resident of Minnesota. I graduated from the University of Minnesota, and I'm now raising a family of seven in rural Albert Lee. Not only am I proud of my Minnesota roots, but I am very proud of the company that I work for, Renewable Energy Group, and the Albert Lee biodiesel plant. We have 12 operating facilities in the United States, and the Albert Lea plant is one of those facilities. I've been plant manager at that facility since 2014, but it just began. That's just the beginning. It was in 2005 when that plant started by Soymore LLC. In 2008, shortly thereafter, that business was shut down. And in 2011, REG purchased the facility and started it up immediately and put in efficiency upgrades and ran the plant strong and hard since then. We employ 32 Minnesotans. We've grown that number as we've increased our ability to produce, and we are hoping to increase that number some more. We also influence approximately 800 local jobs and further. There's a large network of infrastructure and commercial operations, and we feel that at the plant there's a significant impact on the community. The plant was built with an initial capacity of 30 million gallons. We now have produced significantly more than that. Last year, we produced a record 38-plus million gallons in 2016. We are now also working with the state of Minnesota to increase our allowable run rate to 44 million gallons per year. And we are confident we can make gains in that direction. In May and November of 2016, REG Albert Lea produced 3.6 million gallons per year in those 2 months, and that was a record. We also produced over 3 million gallons, 9 out of 12 months last year. And we are strong supporters of the usage requirement and to help to meet that need. I am very proud of our facility. I am very proud of our team. Our team works very hard. They're very smart. They work tirelessly to improve our plant. We have a great safety record. We are strong environmental stewards, and we are happy to serve in Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you much. Thank you very much. Nice job testifying, Mr. Christensen.
Excuse me. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brian Christensen. I'm the general manager of several facilities for REG, but more in particular in this case is the Albert Lea facility. I am a transplant Minnesotan. I'm originally from Indiana and decided I would like to live in southern Minnesota, and just so happened I raised my family in Owatonna, Minnesota. So as you heard from Ted, and yes, I saw some snickering here about seven kids, and I still can't believe it myself, but that is what it is. But there's more to the story that we have here. REG has actually invested $25 million into the Albert Lea facility since acquisition. Main reason why, with the tone of the state of Minnesota giving us good, clear signals that they were interested in the future of biofuels and up and going from B5 to B10 to B20, we wanted to be able to have the capacity and the capabilities to produce the biodiesel that we needed for the state. So, REG actually prioritizes plant upgrades, and based off of economic interest, and as I said already, because of the fact that Minnesota has sent strong signals that they are for biodiesel as well as the renewable industry. So specifically, when you talk about the upgrades, we actually increased our capabilities of pretreatment, as well as we also did some downstream distillation, and it's gone very well. But we also done more than that as well. We've done a lot of loadout improvements to get the trucks in and out of the facility quicker. And Ted's team has done a heck of a job doing a lot of debottlenecking to allow us to do continuous improvement. So we go from 30 to 38 to potentially 44 million gallons a year. With these upgrades, what we can do now is take in not only refined oils, but we also can take in used cooking oil that you get from greasers and fryers and stuff like that. We also are able to get inedible corn oil from the ethanol facilities as well, and as well as, believe it or not, animal fats. We can process that as well in that facility. And that's the reason why we're able today to be able to go more than 30 million gallons a year of production, which was our original nameplate when we acquired the facility in 2011. With all the upgrades that we've done, we're now able to buy over $100 million worth of feedstock on an annualized basis. So that's a lot of money going back into the state of Minnesota. We have supported the state of Minnesota by investing here, creating jobs, and paying into the community, whether it's the increased value of the soybean or other commodities, like used cooking oils, animal fats, greases, and so on and so forth, as well as inedible corn oil. The biodiesel program in this state is meeting the goals established, supporting the rural economy, bringing jobs to the state, and cleaning the air that we all breathe, especially here in the Twin Cities area. We believe the state is more than ready to move forward with B20. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Christiansen. Any questions, members? Not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Nice
job.
Mr. Willers from the soybean growers and Mr. Austin from the soybean processors, if you guys both want to come down, that would be appreciated. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee. Whoever wants to go first can. Please identify yourself for the tape and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representatives, my name is Scott Austin. I'm the CEO of Minnesota Soybean Processors in Brewster, Minnesota. I represent an organization of about 2,300 farmer investors in our cooperative. They have, of which about 1,800 are Minnesota residents. So our local cooperative company, we are a fully integrated soybean crush facility, which means we bring raw soybeans in and produce meal and oil, and from that oil we produce about 35 million gallons of biodiesel a year. Our nameplate is 30 million gallons, but through improvements in efficiencies and the ability to run more days per year, we've been able to push that production number up well above our nameplate capacity. Biodiesel for us represents an opportunity to integrate our business fully from the field all the way through the complete processing of the soybean. This is an important part of our economic model for our business, and it represents a huge amount of value back to our investors as well as other producers in the area for their soybeans. Our primary goal is to consume about half to a little more of our soybean oil with our biodiesel plant. And our biodiesel production employs about 20 full-time employees at our facility. Overall, we employ about 85 employees at MNSP. I think that what our investors did, expanding to biodiesel in 2005, they took about a $20 million capital investment and a huge risk to add biodiesel into their mix from just being a crush facility. That has been a long, hard road for this company. Over the last few years, though, the fruit of that labor has been realized, and we look at biodiesel as a key component of our business and the value that we return to our investors and to the local farming community in general. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Austin. And where did you say your facility was?
We are in Brewster, Minnesota, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Members, questions? If not, we will go to Mr. Willers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jim Willers. I'm a member of the Minnesota Soybean Growers, but I'm also a farmer from Beaver Creek, Minnesota, which is down in Rock County in the southwest part of the state. I farm with a brother, a family farm corporation. We're fourth-generation farmers. So back in 2000, 2001, I was one of the couple hundred farmers that came up here to the many trips to all the hearings that this legislator made us all go through, about 11 different hearings over a couple years.
That's what we're good at.
Yes. And then we were up here to advocate. And the reason we were up here back in 1999, 2000, price of soybeans back then was probably about $4 a bushel, which was not sustainable for anybody. And the reason prices were so low is because soybean oil, basically meat, didn't have a home. These crushing plants were all building plants, and they were building large tanks to go with the tanks. They could crush the meal, ship the meal out immediately for livestock, but there was no home for the oil. The oil was a drag on the market. So farmers, we knew that we could, you know, use soybean oil in our tractors, burn it in our tractors and our trucks, but how do we get there? Well, we thought, well, maybe we should go ask the state for a mandate. Well, how do you do that? So we go to the Department of Ag, and they did an economic study, and it basically said we would reduce reliance on foreign oil, we'd use up a lot of the soybean oil, and we'd create a lot of jobs in the state of Minnesota. So that's our message. We went to the legislature, and we started doing that, and eventually, you know, we wound up with a mandate. So, you know, back to the chicken and egg thing. Well, you got to use it or you got to make it. So you need both. So the legislature at that time had the foresight to, well, if you build some production facilities, we'll give you a mandate. So that all worked together. The chicken and the egg, one didn't have an advantage over the other. You had to put a date out there, and it happened. So what happened along the way, we didn't ask the state for any money. Never taken any money from the state of Minnesota. And for that, you guys saw it, and the state of Minnesota gets back about $1.7 billion economic activity every year. The ag community gets about $240 million. I get about an extra 63 cents a bushel. All works out pretty good for everybody. We don't have oil wells in Minnesota. We have oil that we renewably raise every year in our soybean fields. And I believe the Minnesota legislature needs to protect what we have in our oil in our fields in our state and not an oil well in another state. Thank you.
Mr. Willers, what is the price of soybeans roughly these days?
Around in my way, about $8.60.
Okay. Thank you. Members, any questions? Seeing none. Gentlemen, thank you very much. And then the last person I have on the list is Mr. Steve Rupp from Evercat. Mr. Rupp, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members of the committee, I'm Stephen Rupp, and I'm the Vice President of Evercat Fuels from Isani, Minnesota. We're a 3 million gallon per year biodiesel production facility that we've been operating continuously since September 2009. We directly employ 25 people in the state of Minnesota, and our employees are very proud of our facility. We are members of the Twin Cities Clean Cities Coalition, and we know that biodiesel protects Minnesota's environment by significantly reducing particulate matter, hydrocarbons, carbon monoxide, and carbon dioxide emissions into the environment. Our customers remark that biodiesel is easy to use, essentially a drop-in replacement for diesel fuel. Blends of up to B20 are used regularly by our customers on Minnesota roads during the course of the year with no issue. And getting back to a question earlier regarding the blending of the fuel, the majority of our fuel is splash blended, and that has not posed any problems on Minnesota roads over the course of our existence. Our customers believe that biodiesel's performance is equivalent to diesel fuel, and it can be used in a variety of applications, both on-road and off-road. A lot of our customers use biodiesel blends up to B99 year-round, and some of them are in the state, some of them are outside the state, but it is possible, and engines are capable of running high blends of biodiesel. So that concludes my remarks. I'm open to any questions that you might have.
Mr. Rupp, thank you. That's interesting. We have, from everybody today, we've learned a lot. Members, any questions for Mr. Rupp? Not seeing any, Mr. Rupp. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And they're not on the list, and I don't know if they want to come up, but the Department of Commerce, Weights and Measures, wants to come up and make any comments about any of the, or all of these issues. We would certainly welcome that. Interesting to start out with a presentation from the Department of Agriculture and then Metro Transit. I figure we better give back to Commerce to get us back to where we belong here. So welcome to the committee. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is John Kelly. I'm a Government Affairs Liaison at the Department of Commerce.
And good morning, Mr. Chair. I am Julie Quinn. I'm the Director of the Weights and Measures Division for the Department of Commerce.
We came to observe the Department of Ag's presentation on the biodiesel report. Commissioner Rothman is one of the three commissioners that would have to come to agreement to go to the B20 mandate in May of 2018. But we don't have much to add to the very lengthy and informative discussion today other than to say that, to reiterate what our colleagues at Ag have said, that there's been no decision made, and we will be, Commissioner Rothman and Commerce will be present for the biodiesel task force meeting in June. We look forward to hearing from stakeholders and keeping it a very inclusive process. And the department has no intention of creating economic hardship in the state of Minnesota or going into something that is, you know, not ready to go. That's why the whole process is in place, and the three commissioners have to kind of green light it. So with that, I'll turn it over to Julie. And
thank you, Mr. Miller. Ms. Quinn?
I don't really have a lot to add other than to address the question of enforcement, which is actually what the Weights and Measures Division has to do. We did have a gap that we identified when we were at the B5 level on ability to monitor what was happening when bulk delivery services delivered to farms or fleets at places where we don't have the right to inspect. We addressed that legislatively by changing the requirements of what was required on those bills of lading and clarifying that the bio content was allowed or was mandated to be there so that when we used our statutory authority to audit delivery records, we could determine what actually had been delivered to farmers. Once that hole was plugged, we have all the legislative tools that we need to do enforcement, and the difference between enforcing B5, B10, and B20 is it's just a matter of what model you use on the infrared spectrophotometer. So we feel that we're confident on our ability to enforce at B20.
Thank you. And Representative Anderson has a question.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
That's Representative Anderson. That's quite all right.
Ms. Quinn, so just out of curiosity, so what happens if an outfit from North Dakota delivers to a farm in Minnesota B10 or B5?
That actually, Chairman and Representative, that actually is almost a cooperative effort. There's two ways that could come to our attention. One would be the Department of Revenue. When they license people to distribute fuel from outstate into Minnesota, those people, as part of their licensing agreement, sign saying that they will obey all the laws. They get audited by the Department of Revenue, and I have had meetings with the Department of Revenue, and they are aware that when they're auditing, they should be looking for, did this company buy enough biodiesel to supply the mandated amount on the amount that they're delivering? So if they come into a company in North Dakota or South Dakota or whatever state, and they're saying they're delivering, you know, 10 million gallons or whatever it is into Minnesota, and they didn't buy the requisite amount of biodiesel, well, they know they couldn't have delivered mandate compliance. So then they'll give us a heads up. They also have the ability to pull the license if they're breaking the law. The other way we would hear is if somebody else complained to us, brought a complaint to us, and in fact we had a farmer in southwestern Minnesota several years back who said he was actually ordering above the mandate level, and he didn't think he was getting it, and so we went and we looked, and he was in fact not getting it. We tested the the samples straight from his tank. He ended up, the company ended up agreeing to not only not charge him for the tank that they delivered that didn't contain the biodiesel, but they gave him a whole other tank of fuel on top of that, so like another 8,000, 9,000 gallons. So we do have the ability to detect that.
I actually have a complaint about the last tank of gas I bought, if you'd be willing to. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Quinn. I didn't realize the Department of Revenue would be part of this. You know, they've had some issues with the change on the cigarette tax, and we've had a lot of smuggling problems, and actually the Department of Revenue has come for asking for more money from the state because of just trying to enforce the laws and to address the whole tobacco smuggling here that we're seeing in the state of Minnesota, especially around border communities. I'm guessing we would probably experience the same when it comes to this, because when you were little, you could have a farmer that says, I don't want the B20, and they could be taking it across, and so you'd have two partners that are a wink-wink and a nod-nod, and it would be up to the Department of Revenue to say, hey, this doesn't look right. So I'd be curious to look at what the fiscal cost would be for the Department of Revenue to enforce that piece, too. It's raised a new issue for me. Thank you.
And
Ms. Quinn.
I'm sorry, Representative. I can't really speak to, you know, for the Department of Revenue, but in our conversations, we were not asking them to do anything extra. Did they already do audits on these companies to make sure they're paying the appropriate taxes? So as they're auditing, it's not extra work. It's just, where's the biodiesel in here, you know, on work that they're actually doing. So I believe that we are not incurring any extra cost, and it's not a main function of revenue to enforce our statute. It's just an awareness so that they can give us a heads up that there's an issue that then we would need to go and look at.
Members, any other questions? See none. Ms. Quinn, Mr. Kelly, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
And at the risk of going even later than we're supposed to go, is there anybody else in the crowd that wants to speak for or against this this issue? Seeing none, I will say we've had a very lengthy and good and in-depth discussion today. Members, thank you for that. Representative Anderson P. and Representative Johnson, nice to have you both here. And it's probably, being that we're almost in May, our last Commerce Committee hearing of the day, or of the year, rather. So, Lee, thank you for all of your help today, or this year, and today. You've done a very nice job. Peter Strohmeyer and Chelsea Whitman, the two researchers, have kept us on task and where we're going. Representative Slocum, it's been very nice having you as the lead on the committee, way better than what's-his-name last year. Thank you. And, of course, John and Karen, who keep us on track and make sure that everything we're doing, everything that's right, pretty much they've done. Everything where we go late or screw up, that's my fault. And Len Lowry and House Research and everybody else has been great. So good year, good questions. And with that, we are adjourned for the year.